Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, Managing Editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, we've got Dr. Darren T. Okuda of the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center at Dallas, as well as his co-author Karen Cook of Heartbeat Medical Communications, who spoke with us about their research into the wasted costs associated with DMTs for patients with multiple sclerosis, what they've observed at their center, and the wide-reaching impact of this waste on the healthcare continuum. So without further ado, let's dive in.
Hi, I'm Karen Cook. I'm a clinical ethnographer. I work at Heartbeat, a medical communications company, and I'm the medical lead of this neurology department there.
Hi, I'm Darren Okuda. I'm a professor of neurology at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center here in Dallas. I direct two programs, one focused on neuroinnovation and the other involves multiple sclerosis and neuroimmunology imaging. It's probably best to start at the beginning. This effort started in 2017, and the focus was an environmental project. I had the question of, I wanted to understand where these unused therapies were going. Were they being thrown away? Were they being handed out to other patients with multiple sclerosis? And so it really started there, and it involved creating a flyer. And if you were fortunate enough to see it in my clinic room, and if you had the energy to bring those unused therapies at home back during your next visit, I would be fortunate enough to capture that information. And in 2017, we realized that we had a tremendous amount of meds coming back to us. And so we decided to formalize the effort in 2018 with an IRB study. And the recent report that was published focuses on the data collection from that year. I think it's also important to highlight that these specialty medicines in our field are very expensive. The average wholesale price or the retail price per year is close to $100,000 each year with perpetuity.
And then, so ultimately, you know, what was, because again, we're talking about, you know, a study of, I think you guys included somewhere around 420 patients in the analysis. And you know, we're looking at, you know, potentially millions of dollars worth of wasted medication. What's the potential translatability of those results to sort of the wider, you know, MS community? Because I imagine this is not something that's happening exclusively in your office, Dr. Okuda, and it's not something that's happening exclusively at UT Southwestern. So where, you know, obviously, again, we probably need to do research to figure that out. But, you know, just how far do we think that this potentially could go when we talk about sort of across the breadth of the medical community?
I mean, before you jump in, Dr. Okuda, I want to just slow this moment down and say, like, how stunning it is that one doctor in one clinic, in one state, in one year, collected over $6 million of unused disease-modifying therapy. I mean, if we just let that sink in for a moment, and now imagine if we looked at this even across MS centers or regionally in different areas, what might we find? And what are the systemic problems underlying that evidence? So go ahead, Darren.
It's crazy, right? If you look at the amount of potential waste that's out there, it's staggering. And And I was looking at this project from a different mindset. You know, why is it that I can wear a shirt from a retail store, and if I'm not happy with it after a few years of wearing it, I can return it and get a new shirt or get a significant amount of money back from my original purchase. But for individuals who have chronic disease, who are treated and with very expensive medicines, and if they are unfortunate enough to die at day two within their 30-day fill, why is the healthcare system continuing to pay for those remaining days? Because these therapies are so expensive. So I think there are a lot of things that pop up when we start to look at other disease states like rheumatology or oncology. And can you imagine the amount of unused medicines that are out there from consumers? It's just staggering. It makes me feel a little ill because, you know, the other side of all of this are a group of individuals that have limited access to these therapies, yet we're just discarding these treatments. And the additional color of our work includes, you know, where do these treatments end up as well? Some people flush brand new syringes down the toilet. People sell their medicines on online platforms. You know, the disposition of these treatments are also very heterogeneous.
I think what's so interesting about this is that we're finally able to have line of sight into what happens once these therapies get into patient hands. I mean, really the only way one has been able to even try to estimate what's happening is based on medication possession ratio data, right? This one-way push. And we've only known from those kinds of data that a drug has been distributed, but not that it's been taken or if it has been so compliantly, and if not, the reasons why. At best, like these, you know, those kinds of things are captured maybe one-off in the notes, but there really is not a great understanding across the population of MS patients of what is happening with these medications once they're in the patient's hands.
And the interesting thing, Matt, with all of this too, is what we've also uncovered is if you have great insurance, you'll get a 3-month supply of a given disease-modifying therapy used to treat MS. 7 days within that 3-month fill, you'll get another shipment of 3 months. I mean, that is, and if you have a side effect the following week, you'll return to us 5 brand new bottles that are unopened and one that has 2 weeks worth of treatment left. We also see an end of the calendar year push out where patients seem to be the recipients of more disease-modifying therapies than they would want to have or even need. So there are a number of things that we've uncovered from this work that speak to why this waste exists.
And I think in many ways, the study shows us what people with MS already know. It tells us that people with MS are really struggling getting to medications that are sustainable for them, and that there are a great many who aren't compliant with their medication regimens prior to discontinuation. And, you know, I think it also reveals that there is this difference, perhaps, Darren, I think we see this in the data, in what patients are being offered or choosing based on race and gender. And some of this may be about how they're presenting clinically or perceptions in their disease severity. But I think what we're really seeing is the data suggests that Black people with MS may well be tolerating things which white people with MS deem intolerable. And by that, I mean that the disparities in care may be creating a climate in which Black patients either aren't as empowered to speak up or aren't heard when they do speak up about what's not working for them. And I think that speaks to the part of data we found in the differences in both perception of efficacy, lower tendency to switch due to side effects, for Black patients versus white patients.
So we did uncover differences in sex and race and ethnicity through this work. I think the other Interesting thing that wasn't discussed in great depth within the manuscript was we used an electronic platform, a mobile application to recover these meds. You would take a photo, you would answer some questions, take a photo of the medications you had at home, and we'd send out a UPS label through the app and you would send it to us. And we found that patients had a tendency to be more honest with the mobile application, the technology, rather than how they were when they were sitting face to face with us. And so that was really interesting. I think we see this also in other paths of society. It's easier for people to be more forthcoming, perhaps for better, for not, when they can submit something electronically than telling someone verbally that there's a problem.
So Darren, I have a question for you. Were you surprised? Like, were there patients who were returning medications where you thought, I wouldn't have called that?
100%. I mean, it makes you feel bad too. Here I'm thinking like, I thought as if I was doing a pretty good job as a physician. I mean, many patients come to mind. I had a patient that a person who had disease advancement on MRI, had a clinical relapse, had a spinal cord lesion, a new brain lesion, was so very adamant that he was taking his medicine as directed. And we were talking about a new MS therapy. And then I found out through the platform that he wasn't taking his medication at all. And he had returned 11 brand new unopened bottles of his disease modifying therapy and one open bottle that had a few capsules left. And so a number of questions came up as a result of these experiences. And, you know, I think we, at least for me, I wonder what proportion of patients are actually being forthcoming with respect to their true degree of compliance and adherence.
Yeah, and I think it's such a unique window into what's happening outside of the clinic, right? And I know, you know, most neurologists prioritize creating that, like, you have such a strong therapeutic bond with your patients and believe you've built trust. But the truth is, and, you know, we know this, I know this as being a patient and a caregiver, like we want to be our best selves in our physician appointment, in our doctor's appointments. And that doesn't always lead to transparency about whether or not we're following through with our regimens. And I think that it doesn't give the full picture. And I think the picture, Darren, of your exam room, right? That split screen that Neurology Live ran is a real wake-up call. And I think it broadcasts that there is this problem that needs a much greater attention. And whether it's that, you know, patients aren't getting to the right drug early enough, whether, and I can say this because, you know, I'm not a neurologist, but, you know, has too much of the decision been turned over to the patient, actually? You know, that doesn't happen in other categories of medicine. And, you know, for 20 years, it worked to fan out decision kits and let people with MS choose when we had sort of similar profiles among medications. But what if that's not the best approach?
Yeah, so I train for my annual physical. Yeah, that's me being a poor patient. The one thing I wanted to say about that before and after photo, I think what was remarkable was it seemed as if we were playing this bizarro version of Jenga. It was so difficult to stack these therapies. And the one thing I'll say is the more drug we put in the shot, because we weren't showing everything we collected, the less it seemed we actually had. And it took more than 8 hours to set up. It took a number of hours to tear down. And, you know, since this work dating back now to 2018, we've collected more than $23 million worth of unused disease-modifying therapies, therapies used in rheumatology, therapies used in neuro-oncology. And I keep on asking people, how much more do we have to do to create change? Do I have to get 10 or 20 of my best friends in MS together? And then we arrive at a dollar figure at $500 million for people to start to recognize that this is a massive problem. This is the time, I think, where we're going to start to be looking at things very differently, just because of rising healthcare costs, just because of public outcry. And, you know, I was very hesitant in releasing these data because I think it raises a number of uncomfortable questions from all components of this equation or this algorithm, including physicians, right? This work tells me that I need to do a better job as well in terms of what medicines we select for people. Because clearly, if roughly 60% of people are transitioning their disease-modifying therapy, not because that treatment is not holding their disease at bay, but because of a non-medical reason, it raises a number of questions with respect to the ability of physicians to pick the right treatment for that one individual.
But Darren, do you feel like you're picking, or do you feel like there's a treatment you might have in mind that you get talked away from in a discussion with the patient?
So it's all of the above. I think number one that I would put in there would be that third-party administrators really dictate what our patients get. And I have very little say when it comes to coverage from payers. And I think, you know, we're at a different time in medicine. This is not like 20 years ago in MS. I remember, you know, I used to watch, I'm going to date myself, Marcus Welby with my grandmother. When I was a little kid, and, you know, 20 years ago, my opinion is that, you know, patients just took your word for, took your word as being, you know, the 100% truth in San Francisco during my time at UCSF. And I've seen medicine change. And, you know, 10 years ago, there was more trust but verify. You know, now we have Dr. Google, we have people taking a poll on Facebook, a number of different things. Medicine has just changed. And I have no objection with people taking more control of their healthcare, but I think there's a lot of misinformation also out there. The field of medicine has just changed generationally too.
I think one of the things that's really astounding for me that sticks out is just in talking about sort of all the, you know, highlighting all the kind of different angles of challenge that are coming out of this, is especially in MS, there's been in the last 5-10 years, you know, as I'm sure you're very aware, there's been this shift toward that shared decision making, really making sure that the patient is involved in that conversation. If we're talking about going on a new medication, switching to something, whatever it may be, you know, trying to match with their lifestyle needs, especially now that we're at the point where we have such a swath of options for MS. And I'm curious, you know, do you think that part of the challenge too is almost that, you know, we talk about I can't remember the exact saying, but that difficulty in choice, just having so many options, you know, once you get over a certain number, it's almost like it makes it harder because now we just have too many things to pick from. And of course, I'm certain there's no clinician out there who's going to say less options would be better. It's always better to have more tools in the toolbox. But, you know, when we talk about things like what you're saying, Dr. Kuda, there's so many challenges when it's just outside of, okay, we sit down with the patient, you know, how do I narrow down from these, you know, potentially 20 options to maybe the 5 or 6 that are most ideal for this patient? And then how do we navigate once we pick the one we think works? Well, what can we get paid for on your insurance? And then, to your point later, if something changes and we need to switch, well, now what? Now we have to restart that conversation all over. And I'm curious, you know, does that, have we kind of compounded the difficulty in that conversation just with how many options there are and sort of how many hands are in the pot of that conversation?
We have, and this has been well studied outside of medicine. You know, for example, if you're trying to sell someone shoes and you bring out 10 pairs of shoes versus two or three pairs, you're more likely to sell a pair if fewer options are provided to that customer. So there are great examples of that outside of medicine. I think, you know, as a person with MS, it's overwhelming, especially if you're newly diagnosed and you're getting advice from everywhere. And now you see commercials, which also influences you, and you see new therapies coming out. And, you know, that was one of the fields that we had captured in our work. That's the non-medical bucket. So if 60% of people are transitioning their MS therapy for non-medical reasons, one of those non-medical reasons is seeing that new offering that's released into the market. You know, aside from not liking the route of administration, the frequency of administration, wanting to minimize the amount of meds that a person is taking per day, you know, family planning, all these things. So it's really, really scary when you think about it. And people who are newly diagnosed need guidance from specialists to help to navigate through all the available options to find something that, you know, has staying power, right? It is effective. It works nicely with that person's lifestyle. It meets their goals. It fits their risk tolerance. There's enough science behind it, you know, all of this. But one of the challenges we have is the ever-evolving healthcare system. And one of the things I'd like to see that I had my rose-colored glasses on in 2018, because what I had envisioned was this drug exchange program, right? So we have unused, brand new sealed bottles that are returned from a patient. We can't redispense those, but, you know, would a manufacturer be willing to do an exchange? And then those exchanged brand new products that has a solid chain of custody can then be used for goodwill. You know, that's my challenge in this podcast to any manufacturer, is to be the first to commit to something like that. They have already gotten paid for that drug. And I understand there's some manufacturing costs and maybe some royalties that need to be covered when new medicines come off of a conveyor belt. But, you know, I challenge any manufacturer to be the first to step up and to say, look, we're really committed to people that have limited access beyond what we can offer through our sample programs, et cetera. We're going to commit to do this. I mean, I'd love to put that challenge out there, because I think that would really revolutionize at least part of the healthcare system.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, after being originally approved in the United States in 2000, the FDA has cleared a new oral suspension of zosanamide from Azurity Pharmaceuticals, marketed as Zonisade, for the treatment of partial seizures in adults and pediatric patients aged 16 years and older with epilepsy. The recommended initial dose of zosanamide is 100 milligrams daily, although the dosage may be increased to 100 milligrams daily every 2 weeks, based on clinical response and tolerability, to 400 milligrams daily. Those who can tolerate that daily dose and require further reduction of seizures may then increase their dosage to a maximum of 600 milligrams daily. Next, the FDA has granted tentative approval to Avadel Pharmaceuticals' extended-release oral suspension formulation of sodium oxybate, which we marketed as Lumriz, for the treatment of excessive daytime sleepiness or cataplexy in adults with narcolepsy. Previously, the therapy was known as FT218. The NDA was supported by data from the Phase 3 REST-ON study, which was held under a special protocol call assessment agreement with the FDA and showed statistically greater increases in sleep latency with FT218 treatment. Next, the FDA cleared a new tool for Rapid AI's neurovascular artificial intelligence platform called Rapid Hyperdensity as part of the clinical decision support and patient workflow. Rapid hyperdensity allows for quick assessment of injury severity among those with traumatic brain injury and brain hemorrhages, with a goal of improving and speeding up the patient care decisions. The tool uses non-contrast CT scans to evaluate the hyperdense tissue volume during identification and assessment of intracerebral hemorrhages. Finally, Ionis has announced that the FDA has accepted its NDA for tofersen, an investigational antisense medicine being evaluated for the potential treatment of superoxide dismutase 1, or SOD1, ALS. Additionally, the agency granted priority review and set a PDUFA date of January 25th, 2023 for the therapy. Tofersen will be seeking approval under the accelerated approval pathway based on data that showed changes in neurofilament, a biomarker of neuronal degeneration. For more information about these stories, you can head to neurologylive.com or you can check out the corresponding links in the show notes. And now, back to Dr. Okuda and Karen Cook.
Yeah, that seems to be, that's kind of along the lines of where I was actually going to ask you guys next is, you know, among what are the potential solutions to this? Because that sort of does seem like the immediate, you know, if we can figure this out, because to your point, even the sealed stuff, if it can't be, you know, for lack of a better phrasing, recycled in some way to be, you know, then redistributed to a patient in need, you know, the costs of, it's not as simple as just throwing that in the garbage, you know, the costs of getting rid of these medications, you know, these are hazardous materials. They have to be disposed of properly. And, you know, I have a friend with MS, even just thinking about used medications, you know, with, especially now in the time that we're in, you know, in this era of the pandemic, you know, you have patients who are, you know, their apartment at home is stacked with a bunch of biohazard bins with used needles in them because they don't want to go to the hospital because it's in the middle of a pandemic. So you think about just the waste of used medications. Now we're adding on this waste of unused medications that are, to your point, potentially still usable in some way. And I'm curious, you know, so outside of maybe a buyback program or some sort of exchange, you know, is there another sort of, hey, here's a potential kind of right in front of us solution to this challenge?
So those are strategies that we're currently working on. We can't share all and disclose all of what we're working on, but I mean, that's the point of focus, right? Is solution. I think the nice thing is we've actually quantified what waste can be. Well, we've quantified it within a single center from a single provider. Now people can extrapolate all they want and envision what a big problem this is overall. We do have a few solutions, and I just shared with you one that in the early days didn't go over so well. So there are a number of strategies. The other ones that I can share, I think one thing that I should share also is that, you know, who is the ultimate bearer of financial risk? Okay, it is not a third-party administrator, Blue Cross Blue Shield, United Healthcare, Cigna, and the like. It is not. It is not the pharmacy benefit manager. It is the employer, you know, and it's not only the employer, it's the stop-loss insurance agency as well, right? And so there are a number of ways to look at this from a bearer of financial risk standpoint, from a policy standpoint within states, from something broader. And I've done work with our government over the past 3.5 years in helping to fairly or to come up with solutions that are very fair to all parties. And those are things that we continue to work on. So Karen may be able to provide additional information that I may have missed.
No, I think that's a really important, you know, I would wish that it was enough to point out the problem and that stakeholders across the medication journey would sort of rise up in recognition of it and want to change it. That doesn't appear to be what's going to happen. And so I think, you know, the ultimate bearers of the risk, the large employers of you know, multiple lives, and the government really has a role in helping to curtail costs. And, you know, one of the things that occurs to me is that, you know, step edits may well exacerbate this problem, forcing people through medications for which there is potentially a high rate of discontinuation if we look at the data. Meanwhile, the disease marches on, right? So we are putting people in a position where time and the time between visits to address the fact that they may have stopped taking their medication is costly on human health and on the healthcare system. And so, you know, this myopic focus on the cost of medication at the cost of getting the disease under control, potentially in a way that is sustainable for an individual patient, saves so much over time. And if one could sort of flip their perspective on looking at it and broaden the approach to recognizing getting the patient on the drug that's right for them and right for their disease from the get-go, is going to save costs. It's going to save costs overall to the healthcare system, to the employer, to the patient, most importantly. And we're not there. And it feels like the solutions for that are there are many pillars to what needs to happen to get us there. And a huge one is understanding the perniciousness of this disease, making sure patients understand it, so they're not making a choice based on how many times a week they want to take something, but what is going on under the surface with this disease and how short a time they actually have to be able to address that. And that's a conversation that I don't think, or education that is not as broadly available to the patients making these decisions.
The other thing I'll say too is you look at the largest employers in the United States, Walmart, U.S. Postal Service, you could put large financial institutions in the top five. You know, these individuals have no idea as to the degree of compliance or adherence amongst employees. And can you imagine if waste was quantified? I mean, these are monies that are being thrown at medicines that aren't being used for whatever reason, right? It's being paid for. And I think that there needs to be a way for us to have treatments within the United States that are more costly because of the innovation behind it. I mean, I support that. But there also needs to be some degree of fairness and fair balance in there as well, right? So if manufacturers are saying, oh, my drug is great and it's better than this drug, then I think that everyone should put their money where their mouth is. And if no one takes it, then it shouldn't be reimbursed or covered, right? Simple as that. We pay for meds that are being used. We don't pay for meds that aren't being used. But I think there are a number of opportunities when it comes to quantifying waste within organizations and programs that aim to do that in a way that we've carved out. There was a startup that was formed based on this work many years ago. It's a startup born out of UT Southwestern Medical Center called Revert. And this company aims to really revolutionize healthcare by tackling this aspect of it and addressing waste.
I think the interesting part about, you know, Karen, what you said earlier is, you know, you're kind of talking about that dream of that push toward personalized medicine, right? And the better understanding we have of what's going on with each individual patient, the better we can craft, here's the drug that's right for you and for your disease. And I do think that, you know, you pointed out a really interesting problem in that the widespreadness of that education about the understanding of what this specific drug will do for this specific portion of your aspect of your disease, or just what is needed for your disease is obviously, you know, perhaps not up to snuff. And I do think, unfortunately, because of what we're talking about, you know, some of the onus, at least in the short term, while we're kind of turning these larger wheels of solutions, is going to fall on the patients and physicians to have to figure some of this out. And So I'm curious for you guys, what do you think is kind of an immediate thing that, you know, any MS specialist or general neurologist who's out there currently seeing patients with MS, who's having these conversations, what are some of the things that maybe they can do or at least work toward doing in the next couple of years to try to help address some of this potential waste? Because again, if patients are, you know, it's not to extrapolate the data from this one center out, but 60% of patients switching for non-medical reasons, that to me sounds like, well, maybe we didn't talk about the non-medical aspects of the medicine as well as we should have. So is it, and I know, you know, we're running against a tight clock because it's not like physicians have, you know, mountains and mountains of time to spend with all these patients, unfortunately, anymore. But, you know, is part of it just really making sure we're drilling down that in the conversation when we're deciding on what therapies to use? Is it follow up once we start on the therapy, making sure, hey, is everything going okay? Are we seeing the results we expected? Any unexpected side effects, anything you can't tolerate? You know, where are we kind of dry? Do you think there's a specific area that maybe we're dropping the ball a little bit, or there's a disconnect somewhere that's helping drive that?
So clearly what we've been doing hasn't been working. And one of the solutions that we came up with was a companion digital tool that was offered at the time of dispensation of your specialty medicine. And really what that app was able to do was it was able to interact with the user to let them know upon arrival if the medicine was coming and to inquire to see if that patient still had interest in taking the medication despite a long wait that may have occurred because of insurance coverage or payer approval. And then to check in with them once they started. So I think we need to start to leverage, although digital health is very challenging these days, we need to leverage new tools to allow for better servicing of patients if they encounter difficulties. Now that's easy on the medical side. The non-medical side is a bit challenging. And the direct answer to your question, Matt, is I think we need to start to use therapies that are very durable, you know, ones that have a track record of great efficacy, ones that if you receive an infusion or a course of tablets over the course of time, that it has a long-lasting effect. Biologically, I think that allows for patients to be covered effectively to address their condition and would allow for less distractions related to some of the common side effects that really plague our patients when they take things that are oral or injectable. That would be my limbic response to that question. But yeah, I think there's a broader issue here too, is do we need to start to counsel people differently if they're a man and a woman? Men are terrible patients and they downplay everything. Everything's fine. And the spouse comes in and then you have reality. Do we need to change our approach when people are white or non-white? You know, if they're Hispanic, Asian, Black, or African-American, I mean, I think in medicine, we tend to use a general recipe that may not work, right? Because of different cultures, backgrounds, perceptions of healthcare.
I think you raised such a good point, Darren. When we think about some of the work that's happening, you know, Liliana MSQ's work comes to mind just about the high levels of medical mistrust and fear. And the barriers to barriers to care that I think do require a different approach, and recognizing that many people are coming, you know, by the time you see them, they have perhaps only been treated in an emergency department prior or not been seen by a specialist, right? The amount of Black and Hispanic patients who do not have access to specialist care, so that by the time they reach a specialist, the disease is so much further advanced. And I think those kinds of issues around social determinants of health that have been at the forefront of so many conversations in healthcare right now need to kind of trickle down into the individual practices and think about, you know, in what way can my practice be as accessible and as flexible and as comfortable for people to seek care and afford care and be transparent about what's going on and with their care. And, you know, that's something every single individual clinician can take on as a way of thinking about how to provide care that actually helps patients to address some of the medical mistrust that is really, by saying medical mistrust, it's putting it on the patient when really we need to put it back on the clinics and say, you know, in what way is this clinic not providing culturally competent care that is encouraging patients to feel comfortable?
Yeah, it takes the conversation outside of just personalized treatment to personalized medicine, right? Is every patient is individual. So treating all of them sort of with this cookie cutter approach is not always the best path, because to your point, Karen, yeah, not everyone has the same access, not everyone has the same background, not everyone has the same disease. And all of those factors, plus all the ones that I didn't mention, play a role into those conversations and into, you know, how they begin their treatment or management journey through the healthcare system and dealing with their chronic disease. And I do think it is interesting to talk a lot about the medical mistrust, because I do think particularly, you know, Dr. Okuda, you alluded to it earlier, Karen, you brought it up a couple of times. There is clearly a line where, you know, patients aren't super willing to share things with their doctors all the time. I mean, I know myself, I speak to doctors all day for work, and I still am hesitant sometimes to admit, you know, it's the classic, you know, you go to your pediatrician, not your pediatrician, your GP, your pediatrician, whoever it may be, you know, hey, do you drink or smoke? How many people say no? And everyone's lying, you know, it's one of those. And I do think it is a good point, Karen, that onus does ultimately need to fall back on the clinician, because especially when we're talking about patients with chronic disease, you know, we're not talking about just someone going to their GP. We're talking to someone who's going to be seeing you for in perpetuity, you know, building that trust and building that relationship where they are willing to share when things, you know, Dr. Okuda, like what you said, aren't going so well. So it doesn't require their wife or their girlfriend or their friend or their buddy to call you up and say, hey, I know everyone's saying everything's good, but it's not. And I'm curious, you know, Dr. Okuda, from your perspective, how do we begin to do that? Because a lot of it to me sounds like it's just relationship building, but obviously that takes time. And these patients, especially if they're coming to you late in the game or they are a new patient and we're talking about, hey, we need to get you on therapy, we don't necessarily have that time to build the trust that we might need.
It's really difficult. I think as a consequence, beneficial or not, of the electronic medical record, and I can't believe I'm saying this, is, you know, there is a MyChart system for us where people can communicate with us electronically. I think, and we never had that, you know, 20 years ago in medicine. And I think the benefit of that is that people are more forthcoming on giving an electronic message to us than they are at the time of the visit face-to-face. Some people just may not have that degree of comfort in sharing something or in challenging something that's said, right? If they have a given feeling or if they interpret what I'm saying in a certain way that wasn't my original intent, they may come back and try to readdress that on a private MyChart message afterwards. So I think that has helped to improve it. It's tough, you know, that's the art of medicine is putting people at ease very quickly. And those people who are great clinicians just have that general aura and sense, and they're able to do that with the people that they encounter. But it's more than that too, though. And that's the complicated thing about medicine. There's so many facets here, from your insurance coverage to what your personal beliefs are regarding treatment to information that you can now gather at your fingertips. I mean, Google is remarkably accurate when it comes to diagnosis if you type in symptoms. And so there's a lot of self-management. There's a lot of apps out there that, you know, and a lot of individuals who have prominence in society with claims. I mean, it's just, it's a different battle that we have to fight as healthcare providers today. So I think, yeah, I'm from Hawaii, and I like to think that the solution here is to still have that focus on the best interests of that person. And I think that to be genuine goes a long way. And I think when people feel that and see that, that I think that that matters a lot. And that influences outcomes. But I don't think, you know, there's going to be some secret solution because of an app or because of, you know, this program or that. I think it's really connecting with the right people. And I often tell patients that when you see a physician and you have that feeling that it's not going to work, try to find someone else. You know, go ahead, Karen.
To that point, you know, the physician, like when we think about representation and finding a physician, yes, that can be an emotional connection, but it can also be a representation question, right? Finding people who come from the community you come from, and the barriers to diversity in the physician pipeline are extreme. You know, the percentage of Black physicians has increased only 4% in the last 120 years. Can you think of anything that has changed less in 120 years? And only 2.8% of neurologists in the US are Black. And so, like, right there, I think, you know, that is a tremendous problem in terms of people getting culturally competent care, seeing themselves represented in their clinician team, and, you know, the importance of centering anti-racism in medical training so that all physicians, all clinicians, regardless of whether they share the background of the person in front of them, understand their biases, their implicit biases, and how that might be playing out in the exam room, because it does. And if we are not aware of it and don't seek to retrain around it, then we are potentially putting the very people we're there to care for at a disadvantage.
It's so interesting how these, you know, all these, not to minimize them, but smaller issues all kind of consistently play into this kind of one large wheel of challenges that the field is experiencing. And it does seem that, you know, slowly but surely, if we can kind of address piece by piece, you know, everything will slowly sort of start to improve along with all those small changes that are being made. And it can be something, Karen, as simple as you're saying, is just making sure that, you know, you yourself as an individual are doing the most that you possibly can to ensure that you're providing the best care to this specific individual that is in front of you in that moment. And, you know, obviously, I don't think that the solution for any of these problems is going to be able to be executed tomorrow. Unfortunately, a lot of these problems seem to be, you know, going to have to carry long-term solutions that require a lot of people and large efforts to sort of all come together in lockstep. So before we go too far down the rabbit hole of challenges that need addressing, I'm curious, you know, what are kind of the closing thoughts that you guys have based on, again, just the conversation that we've had, the findings with the work that you guys did and just kind of what the next steps are in addressing some of these issues.
So for us, we have an existing body of work that represents an extension from this first report that will speak to what happens clinically when transitions occur. So I think that's very exciting. I think on the science side, pairing clinical outcomes to these medication switches is something that we've been focused on because that can help to provide further evidence of or to support the thought of using more durable treatments earlier in MS, right? To help to reduce that given propensity or likelihood of transitioning to another therapy. So that's one part I'm very excited about. I think the solutions that we're working towards to allow for people to gain access to treatments that are very expensive or ones that they're insurer may not allow coverage for. For me personally, it's very exciting. It's a way to really change our healthcare system and to expand the conversations. I've met with payers, I've met with pharmacy benefit managers, I've met with healthcare systems, and I've met with extended members of the House and the Senate Appropriations Committees. I met with the offices of Rob Portman and Dick Durbin. I mean, I've met great people on both sides of the aisle. And I think work there will really help not only our field, but all fields of medicine in which these expensive specialty medicines are being prescribed. Karen will have a boatload of thoughts as well.
Yeah, I would just add to that the first step in solving any problem is recognizing that there is a problem. And so I think this work has done a tremendous job in pointing out and showcasing the extent of the problem. I would love to see this kind of effort replicated in other environments and other centers regionally to really understand what's happening dynamically in practices across the country. I think that would be a tremendous undertaking toward understanding what patients are doing between their visits and with their medications in ways that we currently do not have not had a mechanism to understand that. And now I feel like this work has opened the door for that. And, the technology associated with being able to survey patients around it out of Dr. Okuda's lab enables line of sight into an area we haven't previously had line of sight to. So I think it's really important that that it continue and that others join. I would love to see like a consortium of stakeholders involved in wrapping their arms around this problem. I would love to see industry wrap their arms around this problem and to do so as responsible citizens of medicine. And really because, if people aren't taking these medications, that's information that anyone producing and distributing medications needs to understand so that we can actually provide the care to the people with these chronic conditions across all different areas of medicine. And if we don't solve it, we're just going to keep perpetuating the illnesses and the costs of those illnesses. And so this is an opportunity and a gift, really, to be able to really understand what's happening so we can solve for it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.